I'm here for Chef.
Chef, I guess. Chef is like actor, right?
Yes, you gotta love it, because it won't help you in the game. It's actually more useful than actor, because it can at least like grant some temp HP.
I'm here for the plus one to charisma from actor, so.
Right. Live from the Mundangerous Chicken Hut in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Yishin.
And welcome to episode 277 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're reviewing the newest release for 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, Tasha's Cauldron of Everything. We'll walk you through it cover to cover and let you know whether it's worth adding to your collection.
So, just a reminder, as usual, when we do these D&D release reviews, we will be taking the week off from the Gates of Morning recap and the Character Creation Forge to make sure we can get through the whole book.
And before we get started, we got a couple of announcements that you all should know about that will affect the podcast in the near future. Shane, I think you might have an announcement that you might want to make.
Well, I guess I've talked about it on Twitter, but not on the podcast. My wife and I are due in just a few weeks. We are having our first baby girl. Well, our first baby, who is a girl. And so, yeah, at the beginning of December, I am going to be dealing with baby stuff for a little while, like 18 years or so.
Oh, much longer than that.
Well, you know, hopefully they grow out of the baby stuff by then.
When they're 27, I'm sure there's going to be yet another financial crisis and they're going to move back in.
By 27, I expect we'll be on the third financial crisis of her professional career.
Professional career.
Right. The thing we used to have in the before times. So that's my announcement. Ishan, I think you also have an announcement.
My wife and I are also expecting a baby in January. Also a girl. We didn't plan this, but I'm excited for both of our children to not be friends, just like
right.
We're not friends.
Just like we're not friends, exactly.
It's going to be great.
And they never met each other.
It's like two ships in the night sending broadsides.
like two ships passing in the East River, but never crossing between Manhattan and Brooklyn.
You know what'll happen is they'll never be introduced, and then when they're in their 30s, they'll happen to meet up, get into a gaming group, and then start a Pirates game.
That's right. Yeah, they'll play the Pirates game we never could.
All right. That, however, does have some repercussions for the podcast.
Yeah, so we are going to make an executive decision here to cut down our release schedule to biweekly. So we'll release every other week. At least for the first few months, you know, as we're getting adjusted to fatherhood, you know, we've already started kind of pre-recording some of our episodes, so we can, you know, manage to have some time with kids and hopefully get some sleep. But, you know, for the foreseeable future, we're going to go to a bi-weekly schedule. And yeah, I think that's it.
Now, we know a lot of you out there are, are patrons of ours on Patreon, and we don't want you to feel like you are not getting your money's worth. So in the meantime, while we're biweekly, we're just going to go ahead and just pause the Patreon. So your credit cards won't be charged. You'll still be patrons. You know, we'll still have the Discord open. The rewards and the codex will still be up there. So we're not taking any of that stuff down. And you know, if you want a pin or whatever, you know, shoot us a message and we'll figure out how to get it to you in the meantime, but it's not a permanent thing.
Yeah. It's just, we just didn't feel good about, like, you know, we kind of made an agreement. We were going to release weekly, you know, and, patrons were supporting us monthly. We weren't holding up our end of the bargain. So, didn't seem fair to keep collecting the money and ask you to decide if that's what you wanted to do. So, Patreon just lets us hit the pause button and we'll make an announcement, of course, before we go back to a weekly schedule. And then we'll talk about resuming the Patreon.
All right. So that'll start up in December in a couple of weeks. So we've still got a couple more weeks with us before you get a break. But for now, here's the cover to cover, Tasha's Cauldron of Everything review, the latest source book from Wizards of the Coast for 5th edition D&D.
Mm-hmm. And can we talk about these covers?
Like the art?
Yeah, like I like the special edition. It's not the Hydro 76 style, but like I'm really digging this. Like this is a cool book on the shelf.
Yeah, it's really stylized. I like that you get a Baba Yaga Chicken Hut. Right out there, you know, let's put it all out there. Even the regular cover, not the special edition, looks good. I mean, the art is nice. You got Tasha on the cover doing the whole witch thing, spell book, magic in hand, cauldron, et cetera, et cetera.
Anyway, cover to cover, I like the cover.
So like Xanathar's Guide to Everything, Tasha's presents new character options. That's almost half the book is new character options, including about 24 new subclasses, although, you know, we'll get into exactly how new all of those are in a little bit. And it totally reprints the Artificer from Eberron Rising from the Last War.
This is a relatively thin book. It's 192 pages, the exact same length as Xanathar's Guide to Everything.
Although I think that's our, like, top pick, our top recommendation if you're going to buy something beyond the big three books is Xanathar's. So... This has a lot to live up to.
Yep.
All right, so Tasha's Cauldron of Everything. It is named after Tasha, the planes-hopping wizard from Greyhawk, originally created by Gary Gygax. Often she's known as Igwilv. Those of you familiar with Greyhawk and sometimes Forgotten Realms might know her as that. She's a tropey sex witch.
Oh, yeah. She enslaved demons and then slept with them for their power.
Yeah. She's the mother of the evil demigod Yuz. I mean, okay, so this is the first like 5e book named for a woman. I don't know that Tasha is like a great choice, but I don't know that there were any great choices. Like, I think it's important to note that like Tasha was not one of the characters that some of the original people playing D&D ran for themselves, right? She's not a Melf. She's not a Mordenkainen.
Well, she would have to be a Felf. You know, female elf.
You're not wrong there. She's not a Dramish, right? She's a character that Gygax came up with, and there are like apocryphal stories about like how that happened. But if you know anything about the history of D&D and fantasy role playing, you know that, you know, you've got a female character and she does dumb, ridiculous things that real women don't actually do.
Mm-hmm.
Her true form is a crone, but she appears as a beautiful maiden. I will say this: there's no art in here, and there are no like references to like the Igwilv and Tasha of old, which is basically like, you know, a wizard robe bustier is essentially like her depiction. Like there's no fishnet, so this is a good advancement of the character.
Yes, yeah, so you're saying the modesty is an improvement.
or not the whole like, my school specialization is harlotry. So like the other books, Volos and Mordenkainen's and all that, the character of Tasha writes notes in the margin. She does marginalia. It's pretty like sardonic. Some of it's even witty. I am on record as not really being a fan typically of this kind of stuff, the way that it's been done in the previous books. But like if I had to pick a character whose tone that I like, Tasha's probably the one.
Like all the other books, it starts with a using this book section. And like the other, you know, in character books, it has an introduction from Tasha in her first person voice.
There's some rules reminders and clarifications. Some of it is just reiterating things from the PHB and others are like explaining how it was supposed to be. Things that have been covered in sage advice. Reaction timing. Here's what your proficiency bonus is. You can't stack those at all in any way. And then it reiterates the bonus action spell rule, which is still dumb.
That's exactly where I wanted to lean in.
All right. Then we get right into chapter one, character options, which I said is nearly half the book. And it starts off with customizing your origin. This is all just swaps. So you can customize your race, basically. If you have an ability score increase from your race, you can switch it from one ability score to a different ability score, one for one, right? You got a +2 to charisma and a +2 to dex, make it a +2 to wisdom and a +1 to intelligence, whatever you want to do. This means that things like Mountain Dwarf, which gets 2 +2s, are probably pretty good.
Uh-huh. You don't say.
There's been a lot of talk about this, people being like, okay, you don't want to be tied to racial tropes for, you know, like D&D species, and I'm on board with that. To me, it feels like, I mean, D&D is a fantasy game generator. It is not a universal RPG system, but this moves it a little bit closer in that direction. And I think part of that is Wizards realizing that people are kind of using D&D as a universal system because that's what they know. And so many more people are playing it now.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a net positive, right? Like, it's sort of always the thing you could have done, but now at least there's a clear and obvious rule that just says, here's how to do it. Go play whatever character you want. You know, if you want to be a Kenku wizard, like, go nuts. You know, just you don't have to be pigeonholed because you have, you know, only three options for high wisdom.
You can do the same thing with languages. Just swap languages one for one from now on that you get from your race, which is great because, you know, you always had to do the whole like, but my dwarf was raised by elves and is that okay? It's good that it's in a book that says it's okay, just do it, it doesn't matter.
Right.
You can also swap proficiencies. This is more interesting. You can swap a skill for a skill. So, you know, you're an elf who gets proficiency in perception. Pick any other skill instead. Doesn't matter. And that's nice because, like, half-orcs get intimidation, but, like, maybe you're just you're a noble half-orc, and, like, why would you be a menacing person?
Mm-hmm.
The other changes, though, I'm glad there's a chart. It's going to be hard to memorize for a while. So you can swap a skill for a skill. You can swap a simple weapon or a tool with each other. They're totally interchangeable. You can swap a martial weapon for a martial weapon or a simple weapon or a tool, right? So like sort of everything below. And you can swap an armor proficiency for a martial weapon, a simple weapon, or a tool.
Okay. I'll be sure to cross-reference this chart the next time that I really want to optimize my proficiencies.
I mean, these are just straight up like slight power boost, right? Because you just sort of look at like, oh, I'm an elf and I don't intend to be using a longbow or a short bow because I'm a warlock or whatever. Guess I'll pick two other things, right? Even if tool proficiencies, why the hell not?
Yeah, bye-bye great sword.
Right. Like, I'm never going to use you.
Great
or
axe. Great club is simple, right?
I mean, if I'm an artificer, I'm going to take a race with as many extra proficiencies as possible and just trade them all out for tools.
Of course you are. Then it also gives you an option to create a custom lineage. So you basically choose whether you're a small or a medium-sized humanoid. You get a 30-foot move speed. You go ahead and pick an ability score to get a +2. Then you get to choose a feat. You decide if you get dark vision or a skill proficiency, and then you learn common and one more language.
This is basically just custom race. You don't really like anything that's portrayed, or you want to play like a half drow, half triton, great, go for it. You know, like, pick what you're going to look like. Again, this is sort of a nice universality. Does it make variant humans less interesting? Yes, but also variant humans were never interesting and people only took them for the feat. And now there are codified rules for swapping out skills. If you're going to get an ASI, you can just switch a skill that you have for a different skill. Great. I mean, people were doing that anyway.
Yeah, sure.
And then subclass swaps. At any level, you'd get a subclass feature. Just swap to a different subclass for that class. I think that's great. It might require training or a quest, or you might have to pay like 100 gold per level in order to do that swap, and you'll just have to come up with story reasons, or it can just happen suddenly. Again, it, like, people were doing this already. Like, you're not going to make someone stick with their subclass choice they made at level 2 for 3 years and they hate it.
Oh, Ishan, how much you forget about power gamers. I can't wait to be reading Theorycraft forums of the right order to take various subclasses in order to get to level 20 to take your max build.
Well, now you have something to spend gold on.
Oh, there's that. Yeah, cool. And then we get the Artificer, which is a full reprint from Eberron, including the errata, which is actually helpful.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of errated stuff that's just the new reprint, so I'm glad it's already incorporated. We're not going to go over all the Artificer stuff. Go back and listen to the Rising from the Last War review if you want all of that. But there is an additional subclass, the Armorer, which is just Iron Man.
It's just Iron Man. It's just Iron Man.
You get heavy armor. You get some cool spells, hypnotic pattern, greater invisibility, wall of force. And then you get armor.
Heavy armor.
With no strength requirement.
Yeah, you get power armor. You get arcane power armor.
Yeah. And then it you have two modes that you can choose. Both come with an integrated weapon. One of them is like Thunder Claws and Temp HP, and the other is a lightning blast from your hand.
Hmm. It's 1d6 lightning, 300-foot range, and then...
additional 1d6 damage per round.
You can add an additional 1d6 damage per round, as well as get advantage on your stealth checks.
300 feet is a crazy range.
That's Eldritch Blast range.
That's more. That's way Eldritch more than Eldritch Spear Blast range. Yes, exactly. I mean, it's cool. You get extra attack, so now there's two Artificer subclasses that get extra attack. Eventually, you can infuse each individual piece of that armor. And then the higher level stuff is fine. Infiltrator is way better than Guardian. Some new infusions. You don't have to play an armor if you want to play Iron Man. There's an infusion that just gives you power armor. It does the same thing. It wraps around your whole body, and it replaces any limbs that you might be missing, which is nice.
I like you can play a Battlesmith, get your armor, and then have War Machine as your defender.
Oh, you totally could. That'd be great. But some other cool infusions, the Helm of Awareness, which gives you advantage on initiative and you can't be surprised. There are robes that let you reroll concentration, and then there's a ring that's basically that is exactly a Pearl of Power. All right, next up, Barbarian. And this kicks off optional class features. Something to keep in mind here, most of these optional class features, I mean, they're DM dependent, but they are not usually swaps for other class features in the PHB. They are just a straight up power boost. This is absolutely power creep. If you use these, your character will just be more powerful.
Right. This is fixing a problem.
Yeah. And kind of fixing a problem, right? Like, I understand why the Ranger is getting alternative class features and it gets a ton of them. But then they sort of felt like, I guess they felt like, oh, we have to give everybody them or so people are going to feel left out. But like a wizard did not need new class features.
This is, so I was thinking about this today, as I spent the day painting, my apartment, in preparation for that aforementioned baby. And I was thinking about like how much of the video gamization has come to D&D, and it's not the fourth edition, like, oh, this is an MMO, like, because we have class rules. This is like hotfix. Patch level 1.0 or 2.0 now, like now the barbarian is not just the barbarian. The barbarian is the PHB plus its hotfix, which is Tasha's. The Ranger is I think more like prototypical in that regard. It got a rework in this book, but like now we just deal with like, oh, what you thought about barbarians is not true if you haven't looked at the patch notes.
I mean, it's a great selling point for D&D Beyond, which will incorporate it altogether without you having to think about it. Mm-hmm. Which maybe that's the point.
I mean, you know.
I mean, it's a good reason. It's an excellent selling point for this book. If you're a player, there is no reason not to be like, hey, I just get extra stuff. You know, here's a book that says I get extra stuff. So I will buy this book and bring it to the table.
Yeah, I now have to buy this book.
Right. So anyway, Barbarians, you can get a new skill at level 3 and level 10. Cool. And you can move move half your speed when entering your rage.
So that's basically you get a free, like cunning action or whatever, right?
Right. I think it's called pounce.
It's a free disengage action because it's half your speed.
So it's like, I don't know. Was that necessary? It seems a little fiddly, but I think pretty much everybody, except for maybe one class, gets at least two. So I guess maybe that's why that's in there.
Sure. I don't know. I mean, yeah, it fixes a problem with barbarians, which is that they have no freaking skills. So,
which was a problem with everybody. You should just give everybody more skills.
Right. Like, hey, new rule. At level 3 and 10, you get to take a skill, regardless of your class. Move on.
All right. So we have Path of the Beast, which is a feral melee fighter. You get a natural weapon, either a bite that regains HP, a claw that procs another attack, or a tail that has reach and can kind of do like a shield effect on you. Eventually, you can choose to have a swim speed and water breathing, or spider climb, or better jumping.
Jumpy so, jumps.
Yeah, yeah. So spider climb it is.
Right.
And eventually, you can share your rage. So con modifier number of creatures near you are now dealing 1d6 extra damage per round, and you get a bunch of temp HP, which is a pretty nice damage boost if you've got a bunch of party members. And this book, it introduces lots of ways to get lots of extra party members, so.
Yeah. And also the Infectious Fury is an interesting kind of like ability of forcing an attack or forcing damage. I don't know. It feels like that one lands well for me with the Barbarian.
Yeah, I like the flavor of it. Especially like, you know, with the ability to sort of like induce rage in your allies. I like the idea that you sort of have like mind affecting abilities. The only thing I don't like about it, and you're going to see a lot of this in this book, is you get a neat ability that has like two or three paragraphs of text because it's kind of complicated, but you can use it proficiency bonus times per day, which is 2 to 6. So it's like, I'm going to forget that I have that.
I'm going to save it until the end of the day.
And right, exactly.
Not ever have that last fight.
I'll use it every single round. All right, next up is Path of Wild Magic, which is not a rage mage, which is a little disappointing, but it's the cool, wacky chaos of wild magic surges all wrapped up in a little rage box. So you get a limited detect magic, which is very limited. And so not that great. But the big thing here is you wild magic surge when entering your rage. It's a D8 table.
It has much less whimsy is what I'll say for this table.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everything is going to have an effect. Although there's a huge difference in the power level of the effects. Most of them are like last your entire rage or they're an ability you can do once per round. But like one of them is just you damage people nearby when you enter your rage. And that's it.
Yeah, one of them is blind, which is like a fight winner.
Oh, blind every round.
Right.
One of them is I have a lightsaber. you get a mini bless ability, and you can also restore spell slots. Those are sort of either or, so it's nice if you have spellcasters in your party, but even if you don't, it's still useful. And then at 10th level, you can reroll your wild magic surge, so if you don't like the one that you got, when you get damaged as a reaction, you can reroll to get a different one. And there's no limit on that, so you can just keep rerolling until you get something you like. You just need to keep getting hit, but you're a barbarian.
A small price to pay.
Yeah.
So then bards are next. We get an expanded spell list, add slow, mass healing word, prismatic wall. It's fine.
These expanded spell lists are, you read them and you're like, wait, they didn't have that spell already?
Yeah, I know. That's where it's like, this is where I'm very thankful for D&D Beyond, because like trying to keep track of like which spells are on which list is a nightmare. Though I will say, this makes me very angry about the spell cards that I've purchased now being further incomplete for the classes that I have them for.
You'll just need to buy the updated versions.
Yeah, I'll get to buy the Tasha's version, I guess.
There is an optional feature where allies can now use your inspiration dice to add to a healing spell or damage from a spell. Which is, you know, more uses for inspiration dice are good. The worst thing about a bard is giving someone an inspiration die and they just never use it or they forget about it or whatever. And then there are the abilities to swap your expertise choices, which is great. Or your cantrips at ASI levels.
Cool. Can't think of how many times I've wanted to get rid of my stupid bard cantrips.
There are bard cantrips besides Vicious Mockery.
I know. The thing is, I thought you could actually swap cantrips at any level because it's a spell.
Okay, yeah, up until this book, cantrips have been unswappable except for the Artificer.
Great.
But now, sorry, Artificer, Wizard's better at it, but we'll get to that. So for Bard, there's College of Creation. You get a Mote of Potential, which adds an additional effect to when someone spends your inspiration die. It's either a reroll on the die, some temp HP, or it explodes. I guess your inspiration die explodes. There's a cool thing where you can create non-magical items, kind of like a conjurer, but eventually you can create items up to huge size. Is that particularly useful? I don't know, but like I love the idea of just making really big stuff.
The value is limited by 20 times your bard level. How expensive is a boat?
How expensive is a cloud? How expensive is this dynamite?
How expensive is a debt pack?
Right. Trinitrotoluene is decidedly non-magical, my friend.
Then at level 6, you get Animating Performance, which lets you create a dancing item, which gives you a stat block. And your dancing item can increase or decrease the speed of any creature that starts its turn within 10 feet.
It can also just smash into things because, you know, it's an animated object.
Yeah.
I made the table dance. It's also punching you.
Yeah, exactly. this bearskin rug.
And then your capstone is that eventually you can animate charisma mod objects, which is really going to slow the table down, but it's a pretty good ability.
Yep. That's what we needed was the summoner part.
Ooh, well, this is the summoner's book. And then there's College of Eloquence, which is just straight up reprint from Mystic Odysseys of Theranos.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Then we have the cleric section, which includes expanded spells, as all the casters get.
Yeah, they didn't have Power Word Heal, apparently.
Yeah, that seems like an oversight.
Right. You can now use your Channel Divinity to refresh spell slots, which is great because so often they're just sitting there because you don't want to use it.
Yeah, finally the use of Channel Divinity.
Right.
For anybody but Knowledge Cleric.
You can swap your cantrips. And then, this is interesting, you can just add an additional 1d8 radiant damage on a weapon attack or a cantrip once per round, and that just replaces potent spellcasting or divine strike, which is kind of nice because there are a lot of cleric classes that were sort of locked into being a ranged cleric and casting spells or being a melee cleric because of you had one or the other of those, and now you can just swap it out and it's kind of all in one.
Yeah, was divine strike on hit or was that once per round?
It was, I think, once per round on hit.
Okay. Then it's fine.
The Order Domain is straight up reprinted from Ravnica. But then you have the Peace Domain, which lets you cast Bless proficiency bonus times per day and gives you your choice of Insight, Performance, or Persuasion. And your Channel Divinity lets you move and then heal a creature for 2d6 plus Wisdom, which isn't bad. At level 6, your allies can interpose themselves in front of attacks for other creatures as a reaction, and then at 17 they'll gain resistance when they do that. This one isn't particularly powerful, but I mean it is the Domain of Peace,
right?
In a war game,
in a game that's all about smashing in doors and killing monsters to take their loot. So cool, you knew what you were getting into.
I like Redemption Paladin a lot more for this archetype. So
then we have the Twilight Domain. This is fine. So you get martial weapons and heavy armor. You'll also get dark vision up to 300 feet, which you can share for an hour. Then you get Vigilant Blessing, which as an action, you can give one creature advantage on the next initiative roll that they make.
And then you can create a bubble of twilight as a channel divinity that lasts for a minute. Allies that end there and within 30 feet gain temp HP and can end a charm or frighten. Eventually, you can give yourself a fly speed a few times a day. You'll get Divine Strike, and then allies within 30 feet of you are going to get half cover as your capstone. This seems very dippable. One level of cleric to get martial weapons and heavy armor.
Yeah, I like this. I think this is a cool concept for the melee cleric. You know, it seems a little... It's a little strange to me that this is the knight domain, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Like, the concept there is like it doesn't quite land for me, but the class features themselves are cool, so I'm fine with it.
Yeah, I would expect it to be more trickstery,
right? Exactly. Like,
or just fey,
right? The Twilight Domain feels to me like either a fey cleric or a rogue cleric, right? Like this is the sneakier version of the trickster,
right? Like you're the Black Knight except with none of the connotations.
Right.
All right, so Druid, optional class features. You now get Revivify, which, again, I'm surprised you didn't have it. Divination, Cone of Cold. And this is great. You can expend your wild shape to cast Find Familiar. One of the issues with Druids in general is that every single Druid has this wild shape, and if you're not using it, you're just wasting this huge bit of power that is factored into your power curve. But now you can cast Find Familiar and at least, you know, have them do scouting if shapeshifting doesn't fit into your concept.
Yeah, I like this. And it comes back to the, you know, Druids used to have animal companions as well.
And like all spellcasters, you can now swap cantrips.
So we start off with Circle of Spores, which is the reprint from Guildmaster's Guide to Ravnica. And then we get Circle of Stars.
You learn Guidance and you get a free Guiding Bolt a few times per day. You get additional uses for your wild shape as well. So you can expend a wild shape to basically turn yourself into a constellation, and you can pick from a couple different constellations.
It's a star map, sir.
Your joints glow like stars, and there are lines connecting each of the stars.
I'm the archer.
Sterling. Sterling. Silver stars. I'm Sterling Archer.
Codename Duchess.
So the archer gives you a bonus action ranged attack. The chalice gives you additional healing, and the dragon gives you a minimum of roll of 10 on your concentration checks.
Then at level 10, you'll get a bonus attack that deals 2d8 damage, and in your dragon form, you'll gain a fly speed. And you'll also be able to swap your star map at the start of your turn.
Yeah, because BB-8 showed up and filled it in. And it was like, this is where Luke is. Oh, hold on. Let me just update my star map. Give me a second.
Yeah. The thing is, from the 3/4 of the map that we had, it couldn't make any sense of it.
But we absolutely no idea where he might be.
Yeah, exactly.
And then at 14, you'll get resistance to physical damage while you're in your starry form. It's fine. I mean, it's no moon druid, right? So
right.
Yeah.
It's also no land druid, so.
All right. Then you also get Circle of Wildfire. You get spells like Flaming Sphere. Scorching Ray is a nice addition to the Druid spell list, but people are annoyed that there is no Fireball, and there is no Fireball.
Why? What's going on here? Stop babying wizard players.
Okay, you can expend your wild shape to summon a fire spirit, which damages nearby creatures when it appears. All creatures, so just be careful where you summon it.
Yeah, oops.
And it's got some ranged fire attacks. And here's a thing about the Wildfire Spirit is it has an at-will group teleport. Creatures adjacent to it can teleport up to 15 feet with it. Like, I think this reminds me a lot of a Blink Dog from, like, you know, previous editions of the game. You could have, like, a companion that, you know, could help you teleport short distances. But, like, this is great. Like, you look through a keyhole. My spirit teleports me to the other side, and now I didn't need to pick a lock or whatever. I just went there.
And now my rogue can get bent.
Right? I hate rogues. Or, you know, hey, I'm stuck behind a force cage. Okay, I'll just try again and again till I make this charisma saving throw because it's at will.
Right.
You'll do an additional d8 on healing or damage from fire spells. And then once per day, you can basically sacrifice your spirit to recover half your HP instead of dropping to zero.
This doesn't feel as druidly to me as the other, some of the other druid like subclasses, but I do like that this is a viable alternative for casters, right? This gets you like basically an enhanced familiar that does some useful stuff on its own, and you still have spell casting, and with the expanded spell list, like, you get some better spells.
Yeah, if you want to, you know, play your druid who actually has an animal companion, this is a decent way to do it. And like, if you don't want it to be fire, then you can just switch to a different element and it'll be fine.
I really don't like the choice to give plant growth instead of fireball, though. Like, like revivify, I think, makes a lot of sense. Like, that's like sort of the nature of fire in like the natural cycle. Plant growth, that seems a bit too late.
Plant growth is a ribbon, should be a ribbon ability, right? Like, it's not worth a third level spell slot. So yeah, it's a little disappointing. Druids would not hurt from some more direct damage.
Right.
All right. Next up is Fighter, who gets a lot of love in this book because first off, you get new fighting style options. There's blind fighting, just straight up blind sight within 10 feet, which I think is a level 15, 13 rogue ability.
Yeah. I mean, so much for your plus one on ranged attack accuracy.
There's interception, which is sort of the, I don't know, it kind of goes hand in hand with protection, but maybe it's just better. As a reaction, you reduce damage to an adjacent ally by 1d10 plus your proficiency bonus. Superior technique lets you just straight up learn one maneuver, even if you're not a battle master. And Throne is plus 2 damage on thrown attacks, and you can draw as part of the attack, which is just something that should have been written into the rules, and now you can only have with a fighter fighting style.
Right. And then there's the unarmed fighting style, which gives you unarmed attack, d6 plus strength modifier, and if you have no other weapons or shield, it does d8. And it lets you deal damage to grappled creatures, which I dig it. It's fine. It's necessary to make that archetype work outside of Monk.
Right. I mean, previously it was Monk or Tavern Brawler, and like, there is no reason to take Tavern Brawler anymore unless you're doing an improvised weapons build, and why would you do that to yourself?
I do think this makes the Dwarven Battle Rager a lot more interesting, because I don't think you're holding a weapon if you have spiked armor.
I think you might be right.
So I don't know if that's intentional or not, but that's such a cool and bad class that
the Battle Rager absolutely needs love. So
yeah, like let the people's elbow free.
I also see unarmed fighting style just showing up in so many builds where you have someone who is supposed to be good at this, right? But like just the game builds where you have to have a weapon in hand. If you don't have it, you lose, 11 of your class features for some reason.
Yeah. I do like the, I also really like the one level fighter dip to get one battle master technique. You can finally put Commander Strike on people much easier. Or for the AC fetishists, you can get parry.
It's worth it, damn it.
Right.
And then as an option at ASI levels, which remember fighters get a lot of those, you can replace a fighting style or a maneuver, which is some nice flexibility. We also get new Battlemaster maneuvers, which like the Battlemaster was already the best fighter subclass, and now it even more so is, because there's so many freaking options. There's also a bunch of these that let you use these Battlemaster dice outside of combat. So like Ambush lets you spend one of those dice to add to a stealth check or an initiative check.
Yeah, it's less Battlemaster and more just like master.
I just really, really want to get everything I can out of my rogue. So
right. So you'll have Ambush, which lets you spend a die to add its value to your stealth or initiative roll.
Bait and Switch lets you swap places with someone, and you both get an AC bonus. Brace lets you attack creatures that move into reach. This is like maneuvers as mini versions of other abilities. Like this is sort of like a mini Polearm Master without having to deal with a polearm.
Yeah, I really like that one, by the way.
It is really good. Yeah,
this gets rid of attacks, and I like that. Commanding Presence lets you add your role to intimidation, performance, or persuasion, which cool, great.
And that stacks up with Tactical Assessment, which does the same thing for investigation, history, or insight. So I mean, you can pretty much add to almost any skill check you want if you stack these up.
Grappling Strike lets you spend the die to attempt a grapple after you hit a creature, which you then add the roll to your grapple check, which I think is fantastic. being able to buff grappling. Like, look, the grapple rules are the worst part of every game. Fifth edition kind of handled it all right, but it's still so useless. Like, cool, make it easier, like, and then give me more effects to do while grappling, and I'm happy.
I mean, it's nice that you don't have to be a rogue to be any good at grappling anymore.
Or a barbarian.
And, for the low price of one superiority die, you too can grind the game to a halt.
Exactly.
And then Quick Toss, as a bonus action, you can make a thrown attack.
So then we get two new martial archetypes for fighters. We get the Psi Warrior and the Rune Knight.
The Psi Warrior is the first of several psionic classes in this book, and they mostly use a similar mechanic called psionic energy dice. So you get two times your proficiency bonus number of dice, and they refresh on a long rest, and also you get one die per short rest. So it's kind of a 50-50 approach.
Uh-huh.
Cool. Semi-Vancian, right? I mean, there aren't enough of these dice to really feel like you're a psionic character.
Yeah.
So pretty much to use any of your subclass abilities, you need to spend a die. You can reduce incoming damage against yourself or someone else. You can deal some extra damage. You can move things with telekinesis. You can fly as a bonus action, knock people prone. Eventually, you get resistance to psychic damage, and you can expend some dice to end charmed or frightened effects on yourself.
You can also grant half cover for 1 minute at level 15.
Yeah, and then at 18, you get the telekinesis spell, and you can refresh it by spending some more dice. So I feel like I could put this together with like a wizard multi-class.
Mm-hmm. Then the Rune Knight is the baby artificer. It lets you inscribe runes into objects and wield them and their power.
Yeah, there's giant flavor here, they're giant runes. So Each of the runes is named after a particular type of giant: cloud, firestone, hill, and storm. Each of them will give you like a passive ability and then an active ability that you can usually use once per short rest. So cloud gives you advantage on sleight of hand and deception, and then once per short rest, you just replace the target of an attack. Someone else got attacked, that's fine. I'm just going to switch you to, and you take the damage instead. Fire gives you tool expertise. Like, these runes are actually pretty powerful. Tool expertise is a thing that only artificers are supposed to get, but go screw, I guess.
Yeah.
And you can restrain people with some fire chains. Stone gives you dark vision and advantage on all insight checks.
Hill gives you resistance to poison and resistance to physical damage for 1 minute.
So go screw, barbarian.
Yeah. Storm will give you advantage on arcana rolls, and you can't be surprised, and your reaction can grant advantage or disadvantage to a target.
So the thing that I think a lot of people were hyped about is that this subclass can change your size. At third level, you can grant yourself large size for 1 minute, and that doesn't matter what your size was before. If you were small, that's fine, you're just large. If medium, also large, and then you'll deal an extra d6 damage per turn.
People were excited about that.
Well, eventually you can become huge for 1 minute.
People were excited about that.
Remember, grappling is limited by your size.
Sometimes I'm happy that I'm having a baby and haven't had time to pay attention to what people want.
So, I mean, I like the flavor of this. It's giants, it's runes. I played a rune priest in fourth edition. I like the idea of like House Sevis gnomes who are like have Mark of Scribing, and they're like, oh, we're going to be rune knights. We're the enforcers. And we like, you know, scribble these giant runes. And also I'm a gnome, but now I'm a huge gnome.
Yeah, I do like that idea of the like the gnomish mafia muscle. You know, there's a gnomish mafia in Sharn. Don't lie.
Oh, there absolutely is. And then the best part of the book, Shane, the Battlemaster builds that everyone was excited for.
Yeah, thank goodness that we got two pages of quick character creation. Harkening back to like second edition kits. Like, great. If you really had trouble to pick between your Battlemaster fighting styles, maneuvers, and feats, we got you covered, I guess.
Right, it's two wasted pages of... You know, that little section that you skip over at the beginning of every class write-up in the PHB where it's like, oh, if you want to build this quickly at level one, here are the things that you should take.
All right.
It's pretty obvious that if you want to build a pugilist, take the unarmed fighting style.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's an audience for that, but it does not need to be printed in a mainstream book.
No, it did not need to take a page count. It could just be online for free. All right, moving on to Monk. A couple additional options here. You can choose an additional monk weapon, a simpler martial weapon that isn't heavy and doesn't have special properties. This is more flavorful, you know, it's mini Kensei. And then key field attack, which people seem excited about it. I don't really get the big deal. If you spend key on something else, you can attack as a bonus action, but you could already make an unarmed attack as a bonus action from your martial arts ability. I mean, I guess this is if you weren't using your action to attack, but mostly you should be using your action to attack. I right. guess it helps four elements monks who are casting spells instead. Yeah.
Then level four, you get quickened healing, so you can spend key to self-heal.
And then eventually you can spend some key to grant yourself an attack bonus on a miss, 2, 4, or 6 to the attack. Which, I mean, feels very monk-ish, right? I don't miss.
Sure. I mean, this will end up running into a limit of how many times you can do this because of your key points. So, like, I'm not terribly concerned about it.
No, it's very expensive.
Though, you know, bounded accuracy, get bent.
That'll hit Asmodeus.
30 times. 30 times Asmodeus is 11 AC.
All right, we have Way of Mercy, which is a plague doctor, and it's kind of interesting that this is a monk and not, I don't know, a cleric, I guess. But literally, it's a plague doctor. Like, it calls it out in the text, and they've got the like, beak mask. Mm-hmm. You get insight, medicine, herbalism kit, and you can spend key to heal a creature, and you can replace one of your flurry of blows to heal. So I guess that's like, I'm going to punch you twice, and then I'm going to punch you two more times. But one of those punches, I punch myself and heal myself, or I guess I punch a downed ally and heal them. Fine.
Right. You can also use Hand of Harm, which adds extra necrotic damage when you hit with an unarmed strike and spend a key point.
Which, like, monks needed the extra damage, so that's good. Eventually, your healing can end disease, poison, and certain conditions, and the harm effect can poison a creature, which is actually a great debuff because that means that they have disadvantage on attack rolls and ability checks. So against a lot of big creatures, like they don't get a saving throw, they're just straight up poisoned. So if they're not immune, you're really taking out their damage dealing ability.
Then at level 11, when you full flurry, you can heal, and using the harm ability costs no ki any longer.
And then at 17, your capstone, instead of quivering palm, it's once per day, 5 ki points will restore a creature to life.
I mean, this is the monk that you play if you don't want to play open hand, right? Like, this is a pretty cool monk.
I like the mechanics of it. The whole, like, I mean, it's a long death monk that doesn't live forever, but also doesn't have the, like, super creepy flavor of, like, a skull mask.
Yeah, you get the less creepy flavor of a plague doctor mask.
Right. But then we have the Way of the Astral Self, which is atrocious, I think. It doesn't do anything. It gives you extra spectral arms that you can attack with, but you already had regular arms and feet and heads to attack with, right? Like, you get spectral arms. They can get some reach. You can attack with wisdom if you want, but your dex is always going to be higher than your wisdom, and it doesn't do anything for your regular attack, so you can't build a wisdom-only monk, so it doesn't help you at all.
Right. You can see in magical darkness, and you have advantage on insight and intimidation checks.
You can use those magic arms to deflect energy the same way you would deflect missiles, so that's cool. And then eventually your capstone is 5 whole ki to awaken your astral self, which gives you an AC bonus, and you can make some more attacks with those flimsy spectral arms. And that's it. That's all. Oh, and again, if you're incapacitated, you lose this, so you better never drop, or you're going to have to spend 5 more ki again.
Yeah. It's a choice.
Yeah. It should feel bad. All right, let's dive into Paladin. You don't really get a bunch of additional spells from Paladin, but you do get Warding Bond, which is probably an oversight. Fighting styles. Blessed Warrior gives you 2 cleric cantrips that you cast with Charisma. And then you can also choose from Blind Fighting and Interception.
That's cool. I mean, that just kind of fixes the, you know, missing fighting styles that were, you know, written in this book. So, fine.
And it's an interesting way to fix, like, that Paladins don't get cantrips. It's like, use one of your fighting styles, I guess.
Yeah. Then at 3rd level, you can spend one of your channel divinities to touch your holy symbol, utter a prayer, and regain an expended spell slot. Like, cool, you can smite again instead of using your channel divinity.
Right. I mean, it should have been called regain smite slot, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And you can swap fighting styles, which now it occurs to me that everyone has, you can swap a fighting style so that you can take these new fighting styles.
Yes.
Oath of Glory is reprinted from Theros, and it is still bad.
Then there's Oath of the Watchers, which basically are there to fight extraplanar threats, your Gith, your Mind Flayers, etc.
Yeah, it's... The abilities are a little too extraplanar focused. A lot of them don't do anything unless you're dealing with an extraplanar creature. But the oath spells, you get Counterspell, Banishment, and Hold Monster, which are all excellent. Your channel divinity, charisma modifier creatures gain advantage on mental saving throws, and you can turn extraplanar creatures.
Your paladin aura gives you your proficiency bonus to your initiative, which... Okay, cool. Yeah, +2 to +6.
That's the thing, right? It's one roll, and it's either going to like make all the difference or do absolutely nothing.
Yeah, but you make a lot of initiative rolls. I'm fine with this. Like, initiative buffs, I don't think ever feel bad.
I do find it interesting that this is proficiency bonus and not charisma modifier like all the other paladin auras.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like they're moving away from that, which, you know, I wholeheartedly support. And then the capstone is the traditional paladin capstone. You have a transformation. It's a bonus action, which is good and not a full action. You get true sight and then advantage on attacks against extraplanar creatures, and you have a chance to banish them. But again, if you're not fighting extraplanar creatures, it's mostly useless.
All right, let's talk about Ranger, because there's a lot here.
Yeah. A lot of these are just replacements because no one wants to admit that the PHB Ranger is terrible. Mm-hmm. But I guess we'll just include a lot of swaps. So you can swap out Natural Explorer, which, remember, doesn't do a whole lot, for something now called Canny, which gives you three different abilities. Expertise in a skill at level 1, a 5-foot speed boost, and a climb and swim speed at level 6, which is awesome. And at level 10, some minor healing, and you can reduce exhaustion by 1 every short rest. There is no reason not to take this over Natural Explorer.
Yeah, that's just a straight upgrade.
And these are actually good abilities. I mean, these are things we should have seen in Ranger to begin with.
Then you'll get Favored Foe, which replaces Favored Enemy. Proficiency bonus times per day. You can mark an enemy and then deal extra damage to them once per round using your concentration. So this competes with Hunter's Mark.
Yeah, that's the problem here. I don't know. It's kind of a wash for me. Additional spells. Any additional spells for a ranger are good. You get Enhance Ability, Magic Weapon, Revivify, which is big, and Greater Restoration. Fighting style options, Blind Fight, Thrown Weapon, and Druidic Warrior, which lets you choose 2 druid cantrips and use wisdom. Again, fixing the fact that rangers don't get cantrips.
You also get the ability at second level to use a druid's spellcasting focus to cast your spells, so great.
Right, great. I don't really know what that does. I don't think it means you can use like druid only magic items, which is really what you want.
Yeah.
And then instead of primeval awareness, which was always terrible, you can take primal awareness as a swap, which gives you some additional spells. I mean, they're all nature-y spells, but you can cast them all once without expending a spell slot, and you have precious few spell slots, so it's not a bad choice.
Yeah, I like this as a way to just get pure utility out of the ranger.
Right. Why else? I'm never going to prepare speak with plants, right?
Right. At 4th level, you're able to swap your fighting styles, and then at 10th level, you get Nature's Veil, replacing Hide in Plain Sight. So for this, proficiency bonus times per day, you can use a bonus action to just become invisible for a round, which is better than Hide in Plain Sight and way simpler, and why didn't they just do it this way?
Right, and isn't particularly great, but Hide in Plain Sight is so bad that this is a much better ability.
Right.
I find it interesting that almost all of these are swaps when, like, the ranger was so weak, you could have just had all of these just in addition. Yeah, and the ranger still wouldn't have been too powerful.
Right. It would have been too complicated.
Right, exactly. Now, one thing to note about the ranger archetypes that we get in this book is they all get bonus spells, which means that they did all this fiddling with the PHB ranger, but didn't give them bonus spells.
Sweet.
Right. So, you know, consider that when you're picking the archetypes out of this book, because they're a little stronger, at least in that regard. So Fey Wanderer, like it says on the tin, is a Fey-focused ranger. You can deal extra psychic damage once per turn. You get spells like Charm Person, Misty Step, Dispel Magic, and Dimension Door. And you get to add your Wisdom modifier to all Charisma checks, which just makes you decent at them because you were always terrible at them.
You'll have Advantage versus Charm or Frighten, and you can summon Fey without using concentration for the spell once per day.
And then your capstone is you can Misty Step Wisdom modifier times per day, and you can bring a creature with you. Like, that's a level 15 ability.
It feels like a cool ability, except, you know, like, we already have that Blink Ranger, and this is just a lousy time to do that.
Yeah, it's what happens to all rangers, which is you get a really cool ability 10
after
levels too
everyone
late.
Everyone else, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. All right, then we got Swarm Keeper, which is you got bugs. You got lots of bugs, and they live on you, but they could also be pixies or whatever swarm you want. You deal an extra d6 damage per round. You can choose to deal an extra d6 damage per round or slide a target that you hit, or they can move you. And since you're not doing the moving, that's not going to trigger an opportunity attack.
You get some wizard-type spells like Mage Hand, Web, Arcane Eye, and Insect Plague.
At level 7, you can grant yourself a fly speed for a minute a few times a day, and then eventually you get you grant yourself resistance, and you can teleport a few times per day. If that sounds like that's not very much, it's because it's not very much.
Then we get the replacement for Beastmaster Companions. So the Beastmaster now gets Primal Companion. which are just generic stat blocks.
Yeah, but better ones because the mechanics work differently, right? Like they're in line with like the Artificer's Steel Defender and a lot of the summon spells where they have a stat block that scales based on your proficiency bonus. One garbage thing about them is that they attack using your spell attack modifier, which is going to be wisdom.
Sweet.
And not your dexterity. So sorry, Rangers, you get nothing good.
Yeah. I mean, this is the right way to do this. They should have done this a long time ago. This is how all of these abilities should work. Like, you know, Wild Shape should also work this way. This is just a better formula for doing it. Unfortunately, like, yeah, Ranger still screwed.
Yeah, so it's too little, too late. All right, let's get on to Rogue. There's only one option here, optional class feature, but it's a good one and it's really flavorful. Steady aim. If you give up your movement as a bonus action, you can gain advantage on your next attack. Every rogue should know how to do that.
Yeah. This is good, obviously, because it lets you proc your sneak attack. But of course, you can't move after using it. So it's, you know, you're giving up. I guess you're giving up your disengage on a bonus action, which you've already given up because you, you know, have to spend a bonus action to activate this. I don't know why it's limited.
And then we get the Phantom, which is a rogue that steals souls.
Sweet.
You get a floating skill or tool proficiency from like all the ghosts of the dead people. And then you get an ability called Wails from the Grave. You deal half of your sneak attack damage to a nearby creature a few times per day when you hit someone else with your sneak attack. And then you can capture the essence of a dying creature in soul trinkets and then use those trinkets to do different things. If you have a trinket on you, you get advantage on death saves and con saves. You can crush a trinket and use Wails from the Grave immediately.
And then you can also ask one question of the deceased, and they don't have to answer truthfully. So
what is the point?
Like, I think the point is to use your, is to phrase a, you know, a sardonic question in order to own them one last time. Cause
you know what?
They're certainly not going to help you with information.
I'll take it. That's what my rogue would do. At 13, you get Ghost Walk, which as a bonus action for gives you a fly and hover speed for 10 minutes. You're also incorporeal. Attacks against you have disadvantage, and you can renew that by crushing another trinket. And eventually you start with a trinket after a long rest. Next up is the Soul Knife, which is the psionic version of the Rogue. And the thing I like about the Soul Knife the most, like mechanics aside, is that, you know, like all Soul Knives, you manifest these like psychic blades out of your hands, but it very clearly calls out that they appear when you make the attack, and as soon as the attack is over, they disappear. I walk around always armed and also never armed.
Right.
Did I need to make a check to conceal these weapons when the inspector comes around the corner right after I've stabbed this man? No, it just automatically happens. Good sir, what are you talking about? There's no blade upon me.
You can use your psionic energy dice to reroll a skill or tool check, and you only expend the die if you're successful on the roll. So that's super good. I mean, that's basically advantage, but, you know, better because it can stack with advantage.
You can use dice to grant a group of creatures telepathy with each other as long as they're within 1 mile, which is such a good ability for a rogue. You get those psychic blades, which are 1d6 finesse thrown weapons. And when you have them, you can make a bonus action 1d4 damage attack. So it's kind of got a built-in to weapon fighting. Eventually, you'll be able to reroll a blades attack with some dice. You'll be able to spend some dice to teleport.
At 13, you can use them to go invisible for an hour. And then at 17, your psionic energy dice can trigger a stun attack.
Which is the only thing that I find sort of like wah-wah, which is, you know, monks can stun at level 5. So
yeah.
I would like a paralyze, but whatever.
Yeah, it's fine. This is fine. Like, yeah, there's a lot of playable rogues. This is another one.
Yeah, I agree. It's no mastermind.
Right.
All right. We are creeping up on the end of these class, subclasses.
Good, because I'm falling asleep.
There's a lot of them. All right, Sorcerer gets Magic Weapon and Demiplane. Cool. Also, new meta magic options. Seeking. spend 2 points and reroll a spell attack, or transmuted, spend 1 point and change your damage type, which is awesome until we get to wizard.
So at your ASIs, you can replace a meta magic or a cantrip. So great. And then at level 5, you can spend 1 sorcery point to reroll an ability check. Fine.
The Aberrant Mind Sorcerer does a thing. It has psionic spells. These subclasses do this thing where you get bonus spells, but you can also swap them out, kind of like the Divine Soul Sorcerer. And you can replace them with a divination or enchantment spell from Sorcerer, Wizard, or Warlock. So you're getting a lot of use out of this expanded spell list.
At level 6, you can cast psionic spells with your spell points, and you can automatically cast as a subtle spell. And you also gain resistance to psychic damage. So this is a pretty big power spike here.
At 14, you can spend a sorcery point to undergo certain kinds of body transformation. You can choose exactly how much transformation you get. And then your capstone is Warping Implosion, which is like you teleport far away and then all the creatures around you like save versus damage and like being thrown together in an explosion. It's fine, but also like, why are you standing in the middle of all your enemies?
Well, so that you can use your Warping Implosion. I feel like that's a pretty obvious answer.
I had to do it twice, once to get in the middle of my enemies and once to leave.
Right. Then the next subclass is Clockwork Soul.
So you get Clockwork Magic, additional spells. Those are fine, but you can replace them with Abjuration or Transmutation spells from Sorcerer, Wizard, or Warlock.
Mm-hmm.
A few times a day, you can remove advantage and disadvantage from a roll of a creature that you can see, so enemies or allies.
And then you can also spend your spell points to create a shield around a creature, which, you know, takes damage for them.
At 14, for 1 minute, creatures can't have advantage against you, and you get a minimum of 10 on attacks, saving throws, and checks. And then once you've used it, you can refresh that ability with 5 sorcery points. This is great. Anything that takes out randomness, sorry, wild magic sorcerers, is good for you as a player.
Then at level 18, you can spend an action to restore 100 hit points divided any way you'd like. You can repair all objects and end 6th level or lower spells. And this costs 7 sorcery points to refresh.
I like this subclass. It seems powerful enough. There are definitely abilities where you're like, great, I've decided for the next 10 minutes, I'm just not going to fail on anything.
Yep.
There's healing, which is usually hard for sorcerers to come by, and a big expanded spell list.
All right, moving on along to Warlock, who got more Warlocky.
Yeah, they did. You get Teleportation, Circle, and Gate added to your list. And there's a new Pact of the Talisman. The wearer of this talisman, so it could be you or someone else, can get a D4 to failed ability checks, your proficiency bonus times per day. If that seems lackluster, it is, but there are also somewhat lackluster invocations that can beef it up.
Then at any ASI level, you can swap a cantrip, swap a pact boon, or a mystic arcanum.
New invocations. We're just calling out some of the interesting ones. Eldritch Mind gives you advantage on all concentration checks all the time. And Gift of the Protectors, once per day, it's a death ward on a predetermined number of creatures. They kind of like sign up for it in a list.
Yeah.
And then whoever spends it first gets it.
Right.
And then Investment of the Chainmaster buffs your familiar, and now they can attack. They can do more than nothing, right? They can do more than the help action.
Right.
Like, such a pet book.
It very much is the pet and summon book. Then there is the Fathomless Warlock, which is, you know, the patron of the depths, basically.
You get Lightning Bolt added to your spell lists, and you can summon a tentacle, which is basically just a spiritual weapon that looks like a tentacle.
You'll get a swim speed and water breathing. So,
God, well, that would be an oversight, huh?
Yeah. Really, really hope you get to do that. You'll also be able to resist cold at level 6 and speak normally underwater, which is great, except nobody else can speak normally. So only you can talk.
As a reaction, you'll be able to reduce damage with your tentacle, and that'll be every round. So it actually becomes pretty tanky. And then at 14, there's a weird like water source based limited teleport within a mile, which is very not good.
Then there's the genie, otherworldly patron. This adds spells like wish to your
and
list.
Who cares other than that? Yeah, this is the first time I think we get one that's like at level 9. Hey, guess what? You get wish, which I think some people may have overlooked because it's unexpected.
Spell level 9.
Right.
Level 17.
You get a vessel, you know, a lamp or whatever. And when it's on you, you can deal proficiency bonus damage with an attack once per round. So a mini hex blade. And eventually you'll be able to use a bonus action to fly for 10, like a genie.
At level 10, you can take a 10-minute short rest, which, cool. Great.
And then level 14, this is the first time in this book we see these kinds of things. You get limited wish, cast any spell, no matter the class, of 6th level or lower. That's great. And then it recharges in 1d4 short rests, which is like, why have it?
It's fine.
Like, it's more limited wish is like harder to come by than regular wish.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that a warlock with an extra 6th level or lower spell per day is going to really like cause a problem. So like 1d4 long rests is just, it's too much. Just make it once per day. It's fine.
Yeah. There's not even a place on your sheet to mark how many
short rests or right. long rests. Yeah.
All right. Now wizard. I didn't know wizards needed additional spells, but they get them. Augury, enhance ability, speak with dead, divination. And of course you can swap cantrips. Not at an ASI level, on a long rest.
Oh, sweet. I thought cantrips were like that thing that you spent your entire like beginning of your wizard school memorizing and mastering, and you could just do it like the back of your hand. But apparently, you've mastered all of the cantrips, and you just have to recall one today.
Yeah, well, because wizards are just better than you.
Right.
That's why I went to wizard school.
I went to wizard college.
Oh, yeah, all wizards are Gryffindors in D&D. Blade Singing is reprinted from Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide. Note that there is no longer a racial restriction.
And then there is the Order of Scribes, which their big thing is they get to swap damage types. So
screw you, sorcerer. You finally got the ability to swap damage types, and now the wizard does it better than you. Because of course they do. Level 10, you can create an empowered scroll. You basically instantly create a scroll of a spell, but it's at a level higher than you normally would have cast it. Although it only works for you, so you're not like an artificer handing out empowered scrolls.
And then at level 14, with one with the word, you can gain advantage on arcana checks and then sacrifice spells in your book to prevent damage to yourself. So you can now spend gold in order to avoid damage.
I like the little caveat here that says if you don't have enough spells in your book to cover the damage reduction, you immediately drop to 0.
Yeah.
So like, I mean, you're only ever going to use this if you're going to drop to 0 anyway, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. You just keep bouncing off of 0 with this ability.
And then, yeah, you ate your spells in order, like spells in your spell book in order to use this ability. And then they're gone for multiple days as well.
Right.
Like, It's way too complicated. This isn't a particularly powerful subclass. It feels like it's just here to screw the sorcerer.
All right, we're going to push on through here. Let's talk about some new feats that we got.
You get Artificer Initiate, which is Magic Initiate, but for Artificers. Fighting Initiate, which lets you pick up a fighting style.
You get the Crusher, Piercer, and Slasher feats, which all give you... you know, there are half feats that also let you... do something thematic when you hit with a weapon using bludgeoning, piercing, or slashing damage. So I think we've seen these in Unearthed Arcana. They're fine.
Yeah. I mean, there's some neat abilities. Like, you know, the bludgeoning one lets you forced move enemies.
Yeah.
But maybe you could have a build around it, and they're kind of fun.
You also get things like Eldritch Adept and Fighting Initiate, which lets you gain an invocation or a fighting style in lieu of a feat. I think these just... let you lean in more. I think that makes sense.
And Metamagic Adept, which offers you 2 metamagic options and gives you 2 sorcery points to spend on them. A lot of these feats are like, hey, do you want a multi-class and not multi-class? Cool, here you go.
Right. There's also Gunner, which lets you gain firearms proficiency, which, hey, finally we can just use guns.
They exist because Eberron exists now because it's in this book.
Right.
Poisoner, the main thing here is that it lets you ignore poison resistance when you deal poison damage, which is absolutely like the worst thing about a poison build.
Highly necessary. Yeah. So I think that's cool.
Although you can't ignore immunity. So.
Right. Then you get skill expert for a way for any class to gain expertise. Finally, finally an excuse for the variant human.
And then telekinetic and telepathic do what they say they do. You can move some stuff around with the mage hand and do a, you know, a force push, and you can talk to people with your mind.
I think I'm here for chef.
Chef, I get chef is like actor, right?
Yes. You gotta love it. Cause it won't help you in the game. It's actually more useful than actor because it can at least like get grant some temp HP.
You know, actor, I'm here for the plus one to charisma from actor. So
right.
Dames and Dragons. Some have said hilarious. Some have said I cried. Some have said it isn't just the best D&D content I've found. It's some of the best content I've experienced ever.
Some have said Corbin is the best part.
Well, some have said Fran is the best part.
Only you say that, Fran.
Some have said shut up, Corbin.
Some have said this podcast is jam on toast. Some being me, Laika.
Me, Laika have said.
Me, Laika, this podcast.
Some have even dared to say, listen to Dames and Dragons, a D&D actual play podcast on Don't Split the Podcast Network.
All right, so next up we get group patrons. This is basically a slightly tweaked version of the patrons from Rising for the Last War.
Yeah, you get things like religious orders and ancient beings and aristocrats. Some of them are the same and they get, you know, a few updates like military orders.
Then we get the magical miscellany. So there's spells, 17 of them, including rewrites of the Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide cantrips.
And the rumors are true. They have their ranges changed. So you can no longer use them with things like Warcaster. You're not going to be able to twin them anymore, which, like, I
God,
don't know why
cares.
They made those. Yeah, why
God,
did they change them that way? It reminds me of, like, the very clear specification they made in the most recent errata, which was you can't smite with an unarmed attack. It doesn't unbalance anything. We just don't like it.
Right.
There's a spell in here called Dream of the Blue Veil, which shouldn't be a spell. It should just be a lore thing. It's a spell that lets you travel to a different material plane. So I don't know if those do those even exist. Ask your GM. And if they exist, ask your GM if you can just find a portal. Spirit Shroud is a freaking good spell, though. It's cleric, paladin, warlock, or wizard. Third level. You deal an extra d8 radiant, necrotic, or cold damage per hit. Doesn't matter if it's a spell. Doesn't matter if it's a weapon.
That's cool.
And if you, people you hit with that can't regain their HP, and their speed is reduced by 10 feet.
Awesome. That's cooler.
And it scales in power with level.
Okay, what? Yeah, I mean, best third level spell in the game.
Sometimes the best fourth level spell or fifth level spell.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be worthwhile if I'm going to consider casting the spell instead of just smiting.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, you know, it's on Warlock who gets their, you know, scaling spell slots anyway, so that's important for them. This is good. This is a good spell. I mean, this is probably a little too powerful, but at least it's, like, thoughtful about the way that it works. Let's talk about some spells that aren't thoughtful in the way that they work, and are maybe the laziest spells in the game.
You mean the bucket full of summon spells?
Yeah, we said 17 new spells, but what we really meant was that seven of them are going to be identical. And this is the summon spells.
Aberration, Beast, Celestial Construct, Elemental Fae, Fiend, Undead.
Shadow Spawn.
Yes. Pick one of those. Each of them has a different stat block. They have different abilities. They're all at different levels. And they work the same way that pretty much all of the pets do these days, which is, like, you know, you'll give them some orders and they'll go do it.
Yeah. Cool. Great. Whatever.
There's some Tasha's named spells. None of them are particularly good, unfortunately. Sorry, Tasha. And then there's a little bit on personalizing spells. It's another codification of what everyone has already been doing, which is, like, if you want your magic missile to look like chickens, they can look like chickens. Who cares?
Yeah. It's like, hey, DMs, make sure you ask your players what their spells look like. Moving on.
Hey, GMs, make sure you don't yell at your players for narrating what their spells look like.
Right.
All right, magic items. Mostly uncommons and rares. There is one legendary and six artifacts. It talks about magic tattoos, which quite a few of these items are. They go on different parts of your body. They take up different amounts of skin depending on the rarity, which I think it's a nice touch, right? Like, I have a magic tattoo, but, like, it has to cover both your arms and your back. because it's so magical. And like, how do you work that into your character?
Then there are things like the all-purpose tool, which, you know, works as any tool and increases the attack and DC for artificer spells. Once per day, you can cast any cantrip. I like this little Swiss Army knife of an object.
Yeah, there are a lot of items like all-purpose tool here. It seems like Wizards finally realized that everybody needs to be able to increase their spell attacks and DCs.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Amulet of Devout for the Cleric and the Paladin. There's the Arcane Grimoire for Wizards, the Blood Well Vial for Sorcerers. Bard gets one.
There's the Barrier Tattoo, which is a tattooed armor. I think this is a cool way, you know, non-power level increasing, but allows you to change the way that you interact with the world, right? Like, now you don't have to wear armor. You can just get a tattoo and, you know, still use your unarmored numbers.
Prosthetic limbs with a bit of errata from Eberron Rising from the Last War no longer require attunement, which
cool, great.
Is it's a great change. Like, it was dumb to like have to be like, hey, I'm playing a veteran who like lost a limb and has a prosthetic and I have to use up one of my attunement slots.
Yep.
And then there's artifacts like Baba Yaga's Mortar and Pestle, the Crook of Rao, the Demonomicon of Igwilv, and Luba's Toraka of Souls, which, you know, some of you will recognize. Sometimes I like, you know, these are artifacts, so they have sometimes ridiculous abilities. The Crook of Rao, if you roll poorly, apparently Tasha screwed with it, so it just starts spitting out all the demons it's ever banished.
Oh.
Which will it does once per round for 18 years.
For 18 years? Oops. What pray tell is the legendary? I mean, this is so that's an idea, right? That is the inciting incident of your campaign, right? Like, fine,
right. Mm-hmm.
Like, the players don't do this, like, that's what starts the campaign, is like the demon incursion is traced to the Crook of Rao and it now needs to be destroyed, right? Great. Obviously the demons don't want that to happen.
Voila, you have a campaign.
Right. What's the legendary?
It's the Blood Fury Tattoo, which I think is scaled down from the UA versions that we've seen.
Oh, gotcha.
It's 4d10 extra damage, I think like 10 times per day or something like that.
Great.
All right, speaking of your game world, that's all the character options. Guess what? That was a lot of them.
Yeah, there's a ton. Okay, then we get to the DM tools. So let's just run through this.
There's a section on Session Zero, which I think is the first time in an official book. Talks about party formation and the social contract. I mean, there's nothing in here that, if you don't know what a Session Zero is, this isn't going to tell you enough to really do a good one. And if you do, then you already know all this stuff.
Yeah, but still, good that they're shouting out concepts like social contract, hard and soft limits, like that stuff. You know, the more it gets talked about, the more it gets normalized, the better it is. Whether this is the best representation, at least it is in the freaking book.
And it actually says in the book, hey, if there are people who are, you know, violating your boundaries, then maybe you should kick them out of the group. It's nice that it's codified in an official book. It's okay to kick someone out.
We needed that.
We really did.
All right.
All right. Sidekick rules, which give us the updates on those old NPC classes. Now they're expert, spellcaster, and warrior.
My verisimilitude is restored.
Ooh.
So basically, pick a creature with a stat block, CR 1/2 or lower. That's the same level as PCs.
You're right. They get proficiency bonus. They get proficiencies and skills and weapons and armor. They get class features and ASIs. The expert is basically a roguelite. They get cunning action. They can help at a distance. They get some expertises and eventually reliable talent and evasion.
Spellcasters get up to 5th level spells, and then they also get potent spellcasting.
And the warrior gets extra attack, second wind, and indomitable. They're actually going to be pretty powerful. The guidelines are don't have more than one sidekick per character. I think that's going to bloat your party unless you have, like, you know, two players. But it's a nice way to sort of, like, bring up the number if you don't have enough players.
Yeah, I like that. That's the sole reason to consider this, in my opinion.
There was talk about the rules for parlaying with monsters. I think it's one paragraph.
Yep, you got it. We did it. One graph. Now you can go. There's a ton of tables, though. So great.
The tables are cool. What might monsters want from you? Food. I thought it was always meat. We get some environmental hazards, supernatural regions like Blessed Radiance or places touched by the Far Realm or the Mirror Zone. This is basically just lists of D100 tables for different magical effects that will occur when specific appropriate triggers happen. Cool. It's a nice way to be like, what's it like in the Mornland?
Then there are a list of magical phenomena, things like fire, sand, cold storms, emotional echoes, enchanted springs, magic mushrooms.
There's a mimic colony, which is cool. It's not a ton of rules around it. It's the whole area is mimics, and it can do stuff to screw with you, like spit acid at you and, you know, try to restrain you in place and turn into different things. It's the equivalent of a CR2 creature.
Sure.
There's a list of natural hazards, avalanches and falling into water and things like that. But the important thing here, I think, is there are now rules for falling onto a creature.
It's very simple. You split the damage just the way God intended.
Exactly the way I think pretty much every table has been doing.
Right.
Now my druid, who turns into a whale, can actually do something with that.
Right. Then the last 21 pages are puzzles.
Yeah.
I know you didn't ask for puzzles. I know you don't need puzzles. But you got them. Here's some puzzles.
Yeah. It's not a whole puzzle book. It's more puzzles than people who don't like puzzles will want. But here they are.
And not enough puzzles for people who do.
Yeah.
Like, puzzles should be a book. Make a book of puzzles.
People would buy that. People would buy it. GMs would buy it so they could run them. Players would buy it so they could cheat. Win-win. All right, so they break down to easy, medium, or hard. And then the way they work is, like, you present a box text clue and then features of the area. You know, how many pedestals are there or whatever, right? It lays out the solution to the puzzle, and then it lists different hints. So if your characters have proficiency in certain skills, they'll get a hint, or they can make checks in order to get higher level hints. I find most of these, even the easy ones, too hard. In that, yeah, my party will figure that out, but it's going to take them 3 hours until I give them the first hint, and then it will take them 5 minutes.
These we were talking about this, like, these go from being impossible puzzles to being annoying homework problems, right? Like, you just have to go through and, like, the hints just tell you what work you have to do to solve it, and, like, they don't really lead you along the path. There's no real payoff, in my opinion, and a lot of times these puzzles are too, like, archaic to get any sense that, like, based on that, like, based on the situation, that I obviously should have recognized that that's what I needed to do here.
Right. They're sort of like puzzle-y, right? Like, if you have experience with puzzles, and not like D&D puzzles, because, you know, you've played a lot of, like, dungeon crawls, like word games, right? Like, I guess you're supposed to know that you're supposed to match up the number with a letter sequence in the alphabet, and then that's an anagram, right? Like, but if you didn't play the jumble, then why would that necessarily occur to you? What does that have to do with this dungeon?
Right.
There's some info on customizing them, which is nice, right? You've got 13 puzzles, but you can turn that into more puzzles if you make some tweaks and change the difficulty up or down. And then we come to the index,
which is to say, the book's done. There's no index.
No, there's no index. That's always so disappointing. I haven't seen an index in a while.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know quite how useful the index would be in this book. You know, the table of contents does a lot of the work. But yeah, no, they didn't bother to do it. So there isn't one.
What'd you think of the art in this book, besides the covers, obviously?
D&D fine. It's not as evocative as, like, the Eberron art. But overall, I thought, yeah, it's you know, D&D style, and it's fine.
Yeah. You don't really have, like, big set pieces because this is very much a character options book. It is mostly single characters illustrating particular subclasses.
Yeah. And there aren't a lot of, like, the action sequences of those subclasses. I mean, there's a few. Some of them are kind of cool. A lot of them are not. You know, like, but yeah, no, I mean, the art, like, it's fine, right? Like, I think it's not the best art book. It's certainly not the worst art book.
There are no giant headed halflings and gnomes. Yep. So cool.
No creep feet. So it's all good.
Right. And, you know, no Tasha sitting on her throne with, you know, basically no clothes on.
Right. I do want to go back to you and call out, like, this cover is legit cool. I'm very happy to have this this, like, special edition cover, like, absolutely worth going to the local game store, supporting them, picking it up. It's like, it's a cool, it'll stand out because it's got like the kind of like foil finish, but it's also like kind of a cool like green color, which is just not a typical D&D color. So I do like that a lot. I think it's pretty neat choice they made on that.
Totally agree. All right. So we've come to the point where we need to pass a verdict on this book. Shane, I find this book frustrating.
Me too. Because you know what I'm going to say is you got to buy the book. Like, you have to buy the patch notes. Like,
you have to buy the book.
You have to buy a chapter approved every single year so that you can play the latest patch. But, like, sure doesn't feel good to buy, is what I'll say.
There are options in here that I really like. I like a lot of the new maneuvers, the fighting styles. I like the Rune Knight a lot. The Soul Blade is cool, but there are a lot of bad subclasses. I mean, every D&D book has a lot of bad subclasses that are just never going to see play because there are already much better options out there.
Right. I like the idea of a living game system in which you do add options to core classes over time. Right. Like, I like that idea. I like the idea of growing subclasses. I generally have grown to over 6 years. Absolutely hate the way that things get released in bits and bobbles and then reprinted in like differently organized bits and bobbles. Like, it is the worst customer experience that I can imagine. What I do think would be really cool is if they did PHB 1 and they did PHB 2 and they did PHB 3 and they were not supplementary, they were full replacement, right? Where it was, you know, PHP would have to be not just core rules, it would have to be just the character options, but like you actually went through and incorporated your errata and reworked the classes and added the extra options every time, right? And you reset the core game on an annual basis to fix those problems, or every 2 years or whatever. Like, that's an approach, if you're gonna take a video game patch approach, that feels like players can follow along, and you might be able to sell the same book multiple times to the same players without them feeling bad about it.
So you kind of want a 5.5?
No, I don't want that. I don't want that. Like, let me be clear here. I do not want that. But they're forcing it on us anyway, and forcing us to buy a half useful book. So I'm already here. Can you at least make it the customer friendly version? Because I already have, like, this is pieces of three supplements I already own, right? How much stuff in here has already been repurchased? There's Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide, Rising for the Last War, Guildmaster's Guide to Ravnica, and Theros. So four books I already own have pieces put in here. That sucks.
I understand the desire to put like the best bits in this, and I think they're trying to recapture the magic of Xanathar's, but looking at Xanathar's, you thought, oh, here are some cool options, and here are the first options besides the PHB, really.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these feel like the bad subclasses from the PHB that no one plays anyway.
Right. And then Battle
and
Master.
It's already so, right. And it's and like it just doubles down on Wizard and Battlemaster supremacy, especially with all of the additional options, which are cool in theory, but all it means is I'm going to take a Wizard or Fighter chassis and then take a feat to get whatever thing that I wanted instead of like, you know, multi-classing or instead of like playing a different class.
Yeah. This also makes our life worse just in general as selfish people who have to do character creation forge builds, is now there are 300 ways to skin a cat.
Are you sure we're not just going to do fighters and wizards?
that's the meme for a full year. We do only fighter and wizard with feats.
All right. So everyone's kind of going to need to decide for themselves how they feel about this book and the material in it. But in terms of like a recommendation.
Yeah, buy the freaking book.
Yeah, buy the book, right? If you're a GM, there are patches in here. There are upgrades to classes that are kind of necessary and that are going to help your players. And players, it just makes you stronger, and in some instances makes you playable. Like there's a rewrite of the Beastmaster in here.
Yeah, it is one of those things where like if you just straight power creep, everybody needs to just get on board for it and whatever. Like the, you know, strong get a little stronger, some of the weaker ones become playable, like the balance shifts a little bit, but like whatever, it's fine. Like it's still at the end of the day, it's D&D. Like the problems with D&D are still present before this and after this, so like Your combats are still going to be nightmares at mid to high levels. Like, none of that's going to change here. Your summon
spells...
They're
going to be worse, actually, because, yeah, you have all these summons.
Well, no one's going to use summon spells because they're still unmanageable. Like, stop trying to make summons happen.
Well, that's okay. I brought sidekicks.
Stop trying to make summons happen. Summon expert isn't any better than summon D12 hyenas.
Is this just a ploy to get us all to buy virtual tabletops that can manage all of that stuff for us?
I mean, yeah, as a D&D Beyond user, like, you know, this is almost frictionless for us. Really, really leans into the need for that. So I don't know, man.
That's two buys, but you don't have to be happy.
Yeah, exactly. Buy it, but still complain. Capitalism in 2020. All right. Anyway, thanks to D&D. Thanks to the Wizards team for sending us the book so we didn't have to buy it. We finally get the book so we can release a review on time. And what do? We tell people buy it, but don't feel good about it. Great. Okay. This is the last D&D book we get to review. Great.
Please keep sending us those books, though.
All right. Let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes. And before we wrap up, we just want to take a moment and thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show year after year, 5 years in. Remember, we're going to take a little break on the Patreon, so you won't be charged, but you don't need to change anything on your end because we are going to bi-weekly for a few months. IRL.
You can also leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It is a great way to help new people find the show. And if you do that, we will read it on the air. So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about Tundra Adventures.
And in the Character Creation Forge,
we're building Healing Warmth.
Well, that's it for episode 277 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.
Total Party Thrill is brought to you this week by Cobalt Press and the Tome of Beasts 2, now available in the Cobalt Press store.
The publisher of the original smash hit Tome of Beasts, Cobalt Press has wrangled a new horde of wildly original, often lethal, and highly entertaining 5e compatible monsters to challenge new players and veterans alike.
The Tome of Beasts 2 will bring 400 new monsters to 5th edition, from angelic enforcers, Sasquatch and Shriekbats, to psychic vampires, zombie dragons, and so much more. Ishan, did you know that there's an animated bearskin rug that I didn't just make that up off the top of my head when I said it earlier? It was from Tome of Beasts 2!
I like it much better than this table that I had originally animated.
It's a monster, by the way. It is a monstrous monster. Wait, it's...
The regular animated rug was a terror, but now to make it bearskin.
It's a bear. the damage sharing ability is a nightmare, man.
It remembers. Oh, yes. Often lethal, usually lethal exactly. Monsters in this book. So in addition to the Tome of Beasts 2 hardcover volume and PDFs, you can get monster tokens, virtual tabletop versions, and monster layers with beautiful maps.
It includes the work of DSPN Celeste Konowich and James Intricasso.
Oh.
And two other schlubs.
On DSPN? Really? I don't know anyone else on DSPN other than those two. So you can find out more at cobaltpress.com and tell them DSPN sent you.